From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Another bailout and more austerity for Greece, and protests in Athens and Brussels. Press TV's Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
On the margins of an anti-austerity protest involving 60,000 people in Brussels on Tuesday, clashes broke out between some of the demonstrators and police. It was all happening as Eurozone finance ministers were meeting in the Belgian capital to assess Greece's austerity programme. They agreed to unlock further bailout funds for Athens.
Second tranche will amount to 10.3 billion euro. This will follow the first tranche of 21 billion euro, which was disbursed, as you remember, during September to December of last year.
Greece's debt mountain is forecast to reach 333 billion euro this year. It has been agreed that Athens will receive some debt relief.
There is some ground for optimism that this can be the beginning of turning Greece's vicious cycle, circle of recession measures, recession, into one where investors have a clear runway to invest in Greece.
However, some claim that Greece will only have a future if it opts to break away from the EU.
There's only one conclusion, Jerome. They've got to be allowed to leave. They've got to be allowed to. You know, and you need to look at the suicide rates. You know, that's the, you know, not aside of the hunger issues, the unemployment, look at the very real social tragedies behind this. Look at the families that have been destroyed by this.
As in Belgium and other Eurozone countries, people have been taking to the streets in Greece to protest against austerity.
Eurosceptics say there is a major disconnect between the political establishment in the EU and its citizens. Campaigners say the lack of empathy being shown to those who are struggling to make ends meet will ultimately rip the European Union apart.
More protests are being planned in Eurozone countries, but despite this, the European Commission is still insisting that austerity is the only way to bring about economic recovery in the 19-country bloc. Jerome Hughes, Press TV, Brussels.
There were also protests here in the U.S. as protesters gathered outside events for two of the leading presidential candidates. Protesters gathered outside Riverside University in California Tuesday to denounce Democratic presidential hopeful Hillary Clinton as she held a rally there. They demanded that Clinton commit to ending deportations and addressing the root causes of forced migration. A coalition of Latino community organizations led by the Human Rights Alliance for Child Refugees and Families called the former Secretary of State a war criminal and said she was responsible for the coup against elected leftist President Manuel Zelaya of Honduras. They condemned her hawkish record as senator and secretary of state in places like Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, and Palestine. Organizers also stressed that Clinton had called for the deportation of unaccompanied refugee children back to Central America when she was secretary of state and could do the same as president. When it was her turn to speak at the rally, the former secretary of state attacked the likely Republican nominee, Donald Trump.
Trump said the other day, and we saw him doubling down on comments he made a couple years ago, because he said that a mortgage crisis would have been good for his business. This is not ancient history, because Donald Trump promises to go back to the failed policies. He has advocated slashing taxes on the wealthy. I want to raise taxes on the wealthy in America.
Also Tuesday, protesters gathered outside an event for Trump in Albuquerque. They threw burning T-shirts, plastic bottles, and other items at police, who responded by firing pepper spray and smoke grenades into the crowd outside the convention center there. During the rally, the presumptive Republican nominee was interrupted repeatedly by protesters who shouted and held up banners before being removed by police. Clinton's Democratic challenger, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, was in Cathedral City, California, Wednesday afternoon.
This campaign is listening to the Latino community. And the Latino community points out that we have 11 million undocumented people today. That many of those people who are at work right now are being exploited. Because when you don't have legal rights, your employer can cheat you, can pay you below the minimum wage, cannot give you the benefits that you are entitled to, and you cannot fight back. That is why I believe that we need comprehensive immigration reform in this country and a path towards citizenship. Immigration policy should be to unite families, not divide families. And if Congress does not do its job and pass immigration reform legislation, I will use the executive powers of the presidency to do it. Too many people in this country are living in fear. We've got to end the current deportation policies. This campaign is listening to the African American community. And they are asking me why it is that throughout this country, inner cities of America are crumbling, unemployment rates outrageously high. There are communities in America where there are no grocery stores, there are no bank branches, there is no access to decent health care. We are going to change our national priorities. Instead of rebuilding communities in Afghanistan, we're going to rebuild communities in inner cities in this country. This campaign is listening to the Native American community. Everybody here knows that the Native American community has been lied to, has been cheated from the first day, from before this country became a country. And yet our culture, who we are as a people, owes the Native American people a debt that can never fully be repaid. They have taught us so much. Among other things, they have taught us a profound, profound lesson that we must learn. And that is, as human beings, we are part of nature. We must live with nature. And then if we continue to destroy nature, we are destroying the human species. We're destroying ourselves.
Wednesday marked the 53rd anniversary of the formation of the Organization of African Unity, or OAU, now known as the African Union, at a summit in 1963 held in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, where at least 32 African heads of state gathered to promote the rapid decolonization of the continent and to move towards greater cooperation among the various governments there. May 25th is also known as Africa Day or Africa Liberation Day, established on the date in 1958. The anniversaries come at a time of increasing interference from the Pentagon and the CIA into the affairs of African nations. Abiyomi Ezekwe publishes the Pan-African Newswire. In a column published at blackagendareport.com this week, he outlined the history of Africa Liberation Day and some of the history that brought the continent to its current situation, with the U.S. having installed its military influence across the continent. We spoke with him via Skype from Detroit Wednesday. So it's an interesting piece looking at Africa Liberation Day and how things have changed since 1963 until now, particularly with the reappearance of the U.S. military only in even more fully across the African continent.
Yes, and they never really disappeared. In various forms, they have been in Africa trying to destabilize independent governments and to prohibit any real sovereignty, let alone genuine economic development. And this has been the problem over the last 53 years and more. The OAU, the Organization of African Unity, was formed on May 25th of 1963 in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. And at that time, there were 32 independent African states. However, there were tremendous problems developing even during that period. In 1960, with the independence of the Congo, Patrice Lumumba, who was the elected prime minister of the country, had the largest bloc of parliamentary members within the new assembly in Congo. He was neutralized or overthrown. He was forced to flee the capital of Leopoldville. He was kidnapped at the aegis of the CIA. There had been plots even prior to his assassination to kill him. Top Central Intelligence Agency operatives have admitted over the years that they tried to poison his toothpaste. They'd used all types of chemical warfare, psychological warfare, in order to undermine Lumumba's government, which was supported by Dr. Kwame Nkrumah. Later, they eventually overthrew Kwame Nkrumah in 1966. So they have been there from the beginning. Now, with the situation involving the vast reservoir of material resources, such as strategic minerals, oil, natural gas, contiguous waterways with other parts of the world, such as the Arabian Peninsula, Europe. These are the real motivating factors of imperialism in 2016. And this is the challenge of the African Union in 2016. The question is, are they up to the challenge?
Yeah. You know, we saw the, I guess the Bandung Conference in 1955 was the first real large and well-participated in gathering of what was then called Third World, or about to be called Third World countries, of those that were non-aligned in the Cold War, and where the independence movements were really starting to take hold. This was like a transnational independence movement in a way. Then you saw it in the late 50s, the proto-OAS, basically, the movements towards the creation of the OAS in 1963. And that was also during the time that you saw the development of pan-Arabism, Nasser and the United Arab Republic, that included Egypt, Syria, and ultimately was to include Iraq. All of that has been pushed back, and then we saw, as the efforts for deeper integration in Africa started to come to fruition, and we had people like Gaddafi and Gbagbo on the continent, again, another pushback, the bombing of Libya into oblivion, the removal of Gbagbo from the presidential palace at gunpoint by the French, and this deployment of AFRICOM by America's first black president.
Yes, it's very much a reality today. As you mentioned, the Bandung Conference, the African-Asian Summit of 1955 in Indonesia, was a turning point. And it was initially the antecedents of the so-called non-aligned movement, which really came into fruition in 1960 and 1961, and it brought together a broad spectrum of African and Asian leaders, from Indonesia to Egypt to Yugoslavia to Ghana. So this is very, very important, and even the socialist countries paid very close attention to the Bandung Conference and the formation of the non-aligned movement. And you mentioned as well, in modern times, when you had people like Muammar Gaddafi and Laurent Gbagbo, who were pushing for a United States of Africa, who were calling for the African states to form a solid united front against encroaching imperialism, they were targeted and they were moved, by the CIA, the Pentagon, as well as the French imperialist governments. So this process of destabilizing the continent is an ongoing process. And it's quite interesting that Nkrumah, in his speech at the Organization of African Unity Summit, which I quote in this article, that you mentioned, that on this continent, Nkrumah said, it has taken us not long to discover that the struggle against colonialism does not end with the attainment of national independence. He says that independence is only the prelude to a new and more involved struggle for the right to conduct our own economic and social affairs, to construct our society according to our aspirations, unhampered by crushing and humiliating neocolonialist controls and interference. And this statement was made on May the 24th of 1963, some 53 years ago. Today, Africa, for the last several years, was considered the fastest growing region economically on an international level. But just in the course of the last year, there has been a precipitous decline in oil prices and other commodity prices. And this has wreaked havoc on many of the emerging African states. We've seen strikes, for example, in Ivory Coast by oil workers who are saying that they're not getting what they deserve for their labor. We've seen strikes in Ghana and Nigeria. There have been numerous incidences of labor unrest in South Africa. We've seen a precipitous decline in the value of the national currencies of Africa's two leading economies, the Republic of South Africa and the Federal Republic of Nigeria. Both countries are under threat by imperialism. Nigeria, of course, being subjected to an insurgency in the northeast by Boko Haram. In a situation where, even though they're a capitalist country, even though they're allied with the United States, the U.S. Has refused to sell them arms, refused to share intelligence with them in the fight against Boko Haram. We see in South Africa right now where the ruling African National Congress has accused the U.S. Embassy in South Africa of preparing a regime change strategy against their government inside the country. They had threatened them, South Africa, to suspend their involvement in the African Growth and Opportunity Act in regard to the trade of poultry products, which the South African government said the U.S. Was attempting to dump poultry products in the country that did not meet their standards. These are some of the developments that are going on now. Senegal just signed a military agreement with the United States that provides Pentagon access, even further access to that country. We have a situation in the Western Sahara where Africa's last colony is being prohibited from conducting a United Nations supervised referendum on the future of the Western Sahara. But this is being blocked by the Kingdom of Morocco, which is a close ally of the U.S. So all of these things are going on right now in 2016.
You know, and you had mentioned there were 32 countries back in 1963 on the continent. There are more than that now. And one of the games that was played, in fact, as a part of the overthrow of Patrice Lumumba, was to attempt to have a secession of the mineral-rich Katanga province. And now Katanga is again the base of a, U.S. meddling, basically, with Katumbi providing or obtaining mercenaries, U.S. mercenaries.
Yeah, this is very interesting. And those of us who are old enough or who have studied the history of Congo know that it was the Katanga province in 1960 which was encouraged to break away from the Lumumba government. Moise Tshombe, who was proclaiming that Katanga should be an independent state. This provided a basis for the continued Belgian intervention in Congo, as well as the hijacking of the United Nations peacekeeping force in Congo, which Lumumba initially had invited in to try to stabilize the situation. Nonetheless, it was revealed that the United Nations by no means was operating on an unbiased basis or an impartial basis. They sided with the forces against Lumumba. And people like the operative, U.S. Embassy operative, Delvin, who admitted openly that they wanted to overthrow Lumumba and kill him, in which they did. So these things have been happening for decades, and now we have a situation where Moshi Katumbi, who is the former governor of Katanga Province, and is vying to be the president of the Democratic Republic of Congo, has faced allegation that he hired mercenaries to assist him in a bid to become the leader of the mineral-rich state in Central Africa. So these developments are still going on. He's under investigation now by the Congolese government. And something even more outrageous in Somalia, in the Horn of Africa, which is an oil-rich state, which is based on the Gulf of Aden, a strategic shipping lane for the world capitalist system. And there, it was reported that the Central Intelligence Agency had a program through the Somalia National Intelligence and Security Agency to train children as spies for the propped up U.S. and European Union government in Mogadishu. And the Washington Post even reported on this, saying that boys said that the National Intelligence and Security Agency had been using them as finger pointers. They would be sent to dangerous neighborhoods where al-Shabaab insurgents were hiding and told to point out their former comrades. On many occasions, their faces were not covered, although the agents conceal their own. It's scary because you know everyone can see you working with them. This is a direct quote that was published in the Washington Post as well as in Sputnik News in Russia. It goes on to say, the quote, that the children were used on other missions to collect intelligence and sometimes told to wear NISA uniforms. That's the National Intelligence Services of Somalia uniforms. According to the Somalian youth, they were threatened if they refused to cooperate and their parents didn't know where they were, unquote. And this is a project that was set up by the Central Intelligence Agency, which has a field station in Somalia. So in summing up the article, I noted that only an upsurge from genuine left and anti-imperialist forces can even fulfill the visions, you know, of a true united Africa, the same united African vision that Nkrumah and Gaddafi and other revolutionary leaders had embodied. And this is even more important now since we have a worsening economic crisis on the continent. It's extending to all the countries, for example, the BRICS countries, countries like Brazil, where we've seen the government overthrown in a right-wing coup, Venezuela being under threat of an intervention by the United States military that was called for by a former president of Colombia, Uribe. We see numerous threats throughout South America, throughout the African continent. So these are the major challenges that the African Union and the mass organizations and revolutionary parties and national liberation movements have to come to grips with in 2016.
You know, you mentioned the BRICS, and you have Brazil, the B, where this coup just took place. You have India just signing a military cooperation agreement with the United States. You know, Modi was kind of a surprise that he did that to some. You have South Africa, the meddling the U.S. is doing there, where they're attempting to oust the ANC, basically, and discredit the ANC. You have the encirclement of Russia and China, of course, which is well known. And then you had a relatively successful integration project in Latin America and the Caribbean that is being slowly picked apart. The loss of Argentina in the presidential election last year, the state of siege that's been just unrelenting against Venezuela. What do you think, and both in Venezuela and also Argentina and Brazil, you've had this... like part of the left that has actually not supported the government for not because they claim they weren't being left enough. And now this condition prevails where everything that's been achieved in Latin America is on the table. What should the left be doing?
Well, they have to make that decision on their own. But I feel that it's a tactical error not to defend the social gains that have been made in South America over the last decade and a half or more with the process in the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela, coming to power of the Socialist Party in Bolivia, as well as the government in Ecuador, which has taken progressive moves as well, and also in defense of the Cuban Revolution, which is still under attack by U.S. imperialism, and all of the regional organizations that have come together over the last decade to isolate U.S. imperialist policy in South America. These organizations, which claim that Venezuela, Bolivia, Ecuador, Brazil are not, quote, radical enough, unquote, really don't have a strategy themselves. If they were, of course, real revolutionary parties and movements, they would attempt to move into the broader struggles and influence them from a positive as well as a more political manner. This is part of the process. We not only see that in South America, we see it in Europe, taking place in countries like Greece and Britain. We've seen it here in the United States as well. So I was at the Left Forum just this last past weekend. And, you know, these struggles are ongoing in terms of how various left organizations, coalitions, and parties should relate to the mass struggle and how they should work to defend the gains that have been made over the last several decades, even here in the United States. Mm.
And finally, you know, the United States plays a rather effective coordinated game both on the ground in these various countries with the people that they back and also, of course, by projecting their military and economic power directly at the target nation. We've seen a little pushback from China. You know, they have much economic, you know, activity with Africa, particularly South Africa, for example. They're the largest trading partner with both the continent and that country. And last week, in the midst of all of this, and more or less during the same time as the coup in Brazil, China sent a naval task force, albeit a small one, to Cape Town to sit for a little while. Do you see the possibility of some involvement by Russia and China in coordinating with the progressive forces on the ground to push back against this pushback?
We've already seen it. In fact, China is going to defend its own sovereignty, its own interests in the Asia-Pacific region. And we've seen the Russian intervention in Syria, which has staved off the monumental attacks that are being carried out against the government of President Bashar al-Assad in Syria. We know, and there were maps that were put up in various panels this weekend, last weekend at the Left Forum, showing the U.S. military bases surrounding Russia, surrounding China. These countries have no other choice except to defend their own interests.
Okay, and on that note, Abiyomi Ezekwe, thank you very much for your time. A pleasure as always.
Thank you.
That's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.